Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we talk about some of the best books of the year, as well as some of the best reissues of once out of print books with Nancy Pearl, our book reviewer. The one-time Tulsan is the former executive director of the Washington Center for the Book and the author of the Book Lust series of books of recommended reading, and most recently, the editor of Amazon's Nancy Pearl's Book Lust Rediscoveries, which features new editions of out-of-print books written between 1960 and the year 2000. So I invite you to get out a pen and paper or visit our website later today for some great holiday gift ideas, as America's librarian and our book reviewer, Nancy Pearl, joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Nancy Pearl, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. I'm glad to be with you again.
First of all, the year in books. Was it a good year for books, in your opinion, or not so much?
I think there were a lot of books that got a lot of attention. For me personally, as a reader, this wasn't the greatest year I've ever had. In general, for me, this hasn't been the greatest year.
Well, it's interesting. The first book on your list, we actually had him as a guest a couple of months ago. It was a really fascinating conversation. Scott Anderson's Lawrence in Arabia. Now, Scott Anderson is basically a war correspondent. He spends a lot of time in the conflict zones, and he's written this really far-reaching history of the Arab revolt.
Yes, and I think that the great thing about this, I mean, I think if you're going to read about T.E. Lawrence, you really need to read The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, his own view of himself, his autobiography. But if you want to step back and get a picture of what was happening in that part of the world, in the Middle East, during and immediately after World War I, when the Ottoman Empire was carved up by the winning side, then I think a book like Scott Anderson's Lawrence in Arabia is the kind of book that you want to find. And I've read a lot about that period because it's a period of history that I'm really interested in. And I think that Scott Anderson has just done a terrific job of bringing those years and those people to life. And one of the things that's different about this book is that he puts T.E. Lawrence in context with everything and everyone that was kind of operating at that time. People who loved, and this was one of my favorite books a few years ago, there's a book by Georgina Howell called Gertrude Bell, Queen of the Desert, Shaper of Nations.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, we talked about that, uh-huh.
Yes, and I think that that book, the Georgina Howell book and the Scott Anderson book, absolutely go together. They're just a great example of nonfiction writers.
I think the usual viewpoint of the Arab revolt is from the Arab and the British point of view. What's interesting about this book to me is that you see how the Germans are influencing Ottoman policy. There's a German spy master who's a major character in the book. There is a member of the Aronson family, and I can't remember his first name, but he is a Zionist, and he's trying to sort of secure his future between the European powers, the Arabs, and the Ottoman Empire. And then there's also a really interesting look at how the Ottoman Empire was actually operating by the time the war broke out, and how little control Istanbul had over Syria and the Transjordan. Basically, the ruler there was pretty much the ruler of that area.
And I think that that's the kind of book that we need. If we want to be informed about why the world is the way it is right now, Lawrence in Arabia, the Gertrude Bell book, those are the sorts of books that give us that background. I mean, there's the value of history, I think, kind of encapsulated in a book like Lawrence in Arabia. Such a fascinating period.
Scott Anderson's Lawrence in Arabia, not of Arabia, Lawrence in Arabia. The next book looks at big-time college football, and this is by Jeff Benedict and Armin Katajian, The System. And, of course, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football is the subtitle. And I assume this is looking at all the money that's involved in college athletics, the exploitation that happens of athletes. So what exactly?
All those things, Rich, and more. This is a book that you kind of read and weep. There's a lot of scandal and not so much glory to be found in this book. And what it does is look at big-time college football programs, Texas A&M, for example, Baylor, Oklahoma State, Ohio State. You read and hear not only what's happening to the athletes who are being exploited. I think there are other books that are going to be written about that, more to that point, and articles already have been. But you see the need to win at all costs that pervades the football at that level, and how those football coaches, for example, earn more than the university president. You know, the University of Washington just hired a new football coach from Boise State, and he's the highest paid public employee in the state. I mean, what kind of values is that? So this is a book that I was just outraged all the time I was reading it, a kind of pleasurable outrage that there's such a thing. And, you know, it talks about the recruiting methods, the young women, the college students who are used to, if not seduce literally, at least seduce figuratively these high school students into coming to the university. There's a long, long, long chapter in here about Oklahoma State, which is just fascinating. And the only problem with this book, I have to say, and this is what drove me crazy about this book, it is riddled with typographical errors. And I know from my own experience publishing books that typos creep in, but not in this number and not this embarrassingly obvious typos. Mm. You know, at times in this book, I was ready to just give up and throw it away, not literally, return it to the library. But I just, you know, was compelled by the subject to keep reading.
It was interesting. You've talked about the athletics, but, you know, there's the other side of it, which is that these coaches do get paid a lot of money, but really the fortunes of the university a lot of time depend on that athletic program thriving to help fund an awful lot of things at the university. Does it get into that sort of idea that, you know, this tail is wagging the dog of the university, of the fact that
yes,
the money comes in because of the success of the athletic programs?
Yes, and what that leads to. You know, what does it mean that the tail, football, is wagging the dog of the academic programs, the other sports? I mean, what does that mean? That means win at any cost, because the success of your university depends on it.
The name of the book is The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football by Jeff Benedict and Armin Katijan. Up next is a book you have some interest in, and that's an old book by John Cohen, The Man in the Window.
Yes, this is one of the Booklust rediscoveries, the series of 13, a baker's dozen of my favorite books that we're bringing back in print. And John Cohen, this is his second novel, and in addition to those two novels, he was the screenwriter for Minority Report, and which he did much later than The Man in the Window. Now, normally, Rich, I think you know me well enough to know that if a book is described as heartwarming and uplifting and all of, you know, those kinds of things,
that's not going to be a Nancy Pearl best pick.
Right. No, it's not. It's going to, you know, those are books I stay away from. However, there are always exceptions. And The Man in the Window, which is the story of a young man named Lewis Malone, who's so badly burned when he's 16 years old that he doesn't leave his parents' house for the next almost 20 years. And even at home, he wears a bandana over his mouth and chin and a Pittsburgh Pirate baseball cap pulled down low over his scarred forehead. He's now sort of speculated on by the neighbors who call him the Monster of Waverly, the small town where they live outside Philadelphia. And then one day, something causes Lewis to fall out of a second-floor window of his parents' house to kind of enter the world again that way. And he lands on a bush, a rose bush, I believe. And, of course, you know, he's knocked out. The neighbors all rush out to see him because they haven't seen him for almost 20 years. What does this guy look like? And they rush him to the hospital. And in the hospital, he meets an intensive care nurse who is covering the emergency room. And this intensive care nurse is named Iris Shula. And Iris Shula is described by her dad, who loves her, as being 4'9" and 153 poorly distributed pounds. And the relationship that Lewis and Iris develop cannot be described in any way other than uplifting and heartwarming. I love this book. And I really haven't talked to anybody, actually, who hasn't loved this book as well. It's one of those small books that needs the kind of hand-selling that bookstores, independent bookstores, do so well, or that librarians do so well.
And the name of the book is The Man in the Window by John Cohen. Up next is another book about football. This is professional football. Nicholas Davidoff, Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. What is Collision Low Crossers?
Well, Collision Low Crossers is a phrase that defensive coaches use for the act of making legal contact with any potential pass receiver within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage.
Bump and run is another way of putting it. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Right. And if it's beyond 5 yards, collisioning, this is a quote, collisioning someone becomes a penalty. And it also, as Nick Davidoff talks about this, it really embodies speed, aggression, all those things that professional football players need. Now, Davidoff, the author, spent a year with the New York Jets, and mostly with the defensive unit of the New York Jets. And this is a big, literally big book about professional football. And it's kind of like those that HBO series that shows the training camp,
right,
and what goes on. So you really get a wonderful insight into not what you see on Sundays. And there's this amazing statistic in here that in those hour-long, during the game, what we actually see is probably 13 minutes of football in those 3.5-hour things that people are sitting in front of the television. When you're depending on somebody telling a cameraman where to focus, you don't get the whole picture. And so what Davidoff does in this book is really give you the whole picture. It's the kind of books that this one and The System that we talked about before, these are the kind of books I really enjoy reading. I'm not going to say they're the greatest books ever written, but they're certainly great fun to read during the football season.
Now, with the title the way it is, I would expect it to have something to do with, the NFL lawsuits on concussions. Does it get into that at all, or is it just mainly about everything that goes on in an NFL season?
Yes, it's really anything that goes on during the NFL season. There are more books, which I'm sure that you and I will talk about, that are coming out about that whole issue of the NFL and brain-damaged football players from those years and years and years of collisions and what everybody is doing about that. But this one really focuses on the Jets. It's very, is adulatory a word?
Uh-huh.
It's very positive about Rex Ryan. So reading the New York Times yesterday, the sports section yesterday about Rex Ryan, who came to the Jets as a defensive genius, it just puts a whole different interpretation on what we're reading about the Jets this year and about football, pro football this year.
That's Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football by Nicholas Davidoff. Up next, we do have a book with a medical theme, and this is about 5 tragic days in New Orleans after Katrina. Sherry Fink's 5 days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. This has been a very controversial subject over what exactly happened at Memorial Hospital in New Orleans in the wake of Katrina. Tell us a little about this book.
This, I think, is the best nonfiction book that was written this year. Sherry Fink is a terrific reporter. And in looking at the events surrounding and during Hurricane Katrina, what she's done is bring to readers' attention a lot of issues that we don't generally think about, whether we don't think about them because we don't want to think about them or because we kind of push them away because we believe, oh, things like that would never happen. I don't know. But 5 days at Memorial is set, as you said, during Hurricane Katrina. The book is divided into maybe two-thirds and one-third. The two-thirds of the book is an almost hour-by-hour account of the days leading up to Hurricane Katrina and what occurred in the hospital when they knew the storm was coming, and then the storm itself, and then a little bit of the aftermath of the storm. The last third of the book discusses in great detail the arrest on charges of murder of a doctor and two nurses who went through Hurricane Katrina at Memorial Hospital in New Orleans. What I think is so good about this book is that Sherry Fink does not take a position. You would not know reading this book what she thought about the behavior of these nurses and the doctor, whether they were indeed guilty of murder or not. And by just reporting and not offering her own conclusions, she forces readers to really consider that issue. Did those two nurses and the doctor conspire to murder some of the sickest and oldest patients in Memorial Hospital during that time? And it just, I thought this book was riveting. I couldn't put it down. And it made me think a lot about what we do during an emergency. You know, what do you do when you are under these constraints and you have to make decisions about who you are going to evacuate? Are you going to evacuate the sickest, the oldest, those who are more likely to survive? And how do you make those decisions? These are all really important ethical questions that need to be talked about and need to be part of, for example, a hospital's decision-making.
And we should make clear that the allegations were murder by euthanasia as opposed to straight murder.
Yes, right.
But it was very difficult decisions, and of course that's been very contentious, and the state has declined to file actual charges against those doctors, but there's still lawsuits ongoing from that. And it's 5 days of memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital by Sherry Fink. Up next, another older book, which I guess has a new imprint, and this is a young adult book, A Long Way from Verona by Jane Gardam, who's written many, many books.
Yes, Jane Gardam is a wonderful British writer, and Europa Publishers is bringing out all of her books very, very, very slowly. A Long Way from Verona, when it first came out in the 70s, was indeed considered a young adult book because the main character is about 12 years old, a young woman named Jessica Vai. But I always felt, I read it when it came out, I always felt this is not a young adult book. This is really a novel for adults about an adult looking back and writing about her experiences. Now, the book is set during World War II in a kind of small town in England. And Jessica Vai, the book opens, Jessica Vai is at school and an author comes to talk to the class. And Jessica is a writer. She's always written stories and things like that. And so she races home after he gets done talking and sort of meets him at the train station just as he's boarding the train back to London, presumably. And she shoves all her papers, all the stuff she's written, into his hands. And months and months and months later, she gets them all back with a note that says, Jessica Vai, you are a writer beyond all possible doubt, in big capital letters. And I just loved that. I mean, I have to think it's kind of autobiographical, this novel. I have no inside information that says that it is.
You just want to think it's autobiographical.
I do. And, you know, it's a great portrait of that kind of tween age, 12, 13 years old, when you're trying to find your way in the world. And it's really much too, I mean, it's in a sense much too sophisticated for 12 and 13-year-olds. It really is a book for adults who want to look back and see Jessica's experiences and compare it to their own.
That's Jane Gardam's A Long Way from Verona from 1971. I'm going to skip around a little bit. Up next, Adrian McKenty's The Cold, Cold Ground, which I guess is set in the troubles of Northern Ireland, and it's a great crime thriller.
Oh, my gosh. This is so good. This is the first of a trilogy by Adrian McKenty set, as you say, during the troubles in Northern Ireland. This book, it's set in 1981. The main character is a Catholic policeman, Sean Duffy, who is working for the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, which is a mostly Protestant police force. And the IRA do not look kindly on Catholics who are working for anything connected to the British government, because what they're fighting for is independence for Northern Ireland. And this is a book set really at the height of the Troubles Bobby Sands, the first of the hunger strikers in the Mays prison in Belfast, has just died, causing riots everywhere. You know, the police travel around, the RUC travels around Belfast in a big, well-insulated tank. You know, you can imagine what our army uses in Afghanistan, and transfer it to Belfast in 1981. So when I'm reading a mystery, I really want something more than just the mystery. And in this book, what you get, and indeed all three of the books, what you get is a picture. You get history come to life. And so the mystery itself is kind of less than, you know, it's, for me, it wasn't the main thing. But those who are looking for a kind of high-octane, great, sympathetic detective are going to find a high-octane plot, and a sympathetic detective are going to definitely find it in these Adrian McKinty novels.
And the first one of the trilogy is The Cold, Cold Ground by Adrian McKinty.
Right.
Up next, a writer who's written about the Caribbean for most of his life, and this is another in those sets of titles, Bob Shikoshis, is The Woman Who Lost Her Soul.
And Rich, this is, I think, I thought when I read this book that it quite possibly could be one of the great novels of the first two decades of the 21st century.
Wow.
I was that impressed with this book. And I read it at the same time that I was reading the Sherry Fink 5 Days at Memorial. And both of these books, I just found so riveting and so thought-provoking. So The Woman Who Lost Her Soul is another huge book. It's over 700 pages. It's the kind of book that makes e-readers so useful. Because you can't take this book anywhere because it's too big. It's a book that is set over a long period of time, basically World War II to the present. It's set in places all over the world, including Haiti, Montana, Turkey, upper crust golf courses around the United States, Croatia during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
All of those places come into play. The characters are as widely diverse as you could ever hope for. A humanitarian lawyer, a woman, a mysterious woman who, and this mysterious woman's father, spies, a Navy SEAL, a huge range of characters. And the book is written in five distinct yet interrelated parts. And I understand from an interview I read with the author that he wrote it in these five distinct parts because he wrote it over a period of a decade and he didn't know. He was very ill, and there was some question about whether he would live. And he wanted these sections to be publishable as independent entities and then also to fit them into this novel. So when you read this book, you start out, you're in the company of a lawyer, a human rights activist lawyer, who is in Haiti. And Haiti is the place that Bob Shikoshis' first book was written. So he really knows the Caribbean forwards and backwards. But it's in that first section with this humanitarian human rights lawyer that you are introduced to the two major characters, particularly the woman. Only you have no idea where this book is going. And it's only as you go through the book that you begin to see the very, very intelligent way that Shikoshis has woven the stories together. So you're transported from Haiti to Croatia and seeing the results of, you know, the great hatreds in the Balkans played out right in the lives of people that you care about, and how we're going to see the effects of that later on. It's just brilliant. It's brilliantly written. And, I just thought this was a terrific book. Now, since it has not appeared on very many best of the year lists, and certainly wasn't one of the National Book Award finalists, I've started to doubt myself. think, I don't know, you know, what did I see in this book that nobody else has seen? But to me, this is another book, fictional, you know, a novel that helps us understand where we are today. And I think those books are so valuable. So I would love it if somebody else, if many other people would read this book and, and, you know, give me some feedback.
Set you straight. One way or the other.
Set me straight. Right.
Bob Shakosh is The Woman Who Lost Her Soul. The last book, Jency Willett's Amy Falls Down.
Oh, my gosh, Jency Willett. Anyone who loves, anyone who's interested in the state of publishing, in the world of books, in any of the kind of literary atmosphere that is surrounding contemporary America, this is the book for them. It is funny, it is acerbic, and it is just a terrific satire. Amy Gallup, who is the main character in this book, was first introduced in a book, in Jency Willett's most previous book called The Writing Class. You don't have to read them in order at all. But Amy is a blocked writer. Her first novel was published to great acclaim before she was 30, and for various reasons, you know, she had three more novels published, and then she has been finding it impossible to write anything else. And she stays at home. She barely sees anybody. She kind of thinks in monosyllabic terms. And then one day she gets a call from a reporter who is doing a story on has-been writers. Where are they now? And she agrees to meet this reporter. Now, in the morning that the reporter is supposed to come to her house, Amy goes out in her garden, out to her backyard with her dog, and she trips. And she hits her head on the concrete birdbath in her backyard. And when she comes to, she has kind of become a totally different person, someone who is, just as the book is, acerbic, very, very witty. And she becomes this kind of countercultural hero and is invited to academic literary conferences, to speak at universities. And in what she says about the world of writing, the world of publishing, I would just laugh all through this book and just keep nodding in agreement. I mean, I've never met Jency Willett, but again, I mean, anybody who looks at the world through those kinds of eyes is somebody I think I would like a lot.
All right, that's Jency Willett's Amy Falls Down. Nancy Pearl, thank you very much. Have a wonderful 2014, a wonderful holiday, and we will talk to you in 2014. Thanks very much for joining us.
Sounds great, Rich. Happy holidays to everyone.
Some holiday book-giving gift ideas from Nancy Pearl, our longtime book reviewer here on Studio Tulsa. She's the former executive director of the Washington Center for the Book and the author of the Booklust series of books of recommended reading, and the new editor of Amazon's Nancy Pearl's Booklust Rediscoveries. If you missed some of the titles we talked about today, they're available on our website at publicradiotulsa.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.